Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Dr. Serena James is a man of many parts. He is an academic historian, deputy editor of the Catholic Herald, arts columnist for The Critic, fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and a member of faculty at the University of Oxford. But I turn to him today as a colleague at the Catholic Herald to help me rethink the emergence and development of the Catholic Church in this country over the last 200 years. In our conversation, we discuss why it's been difficult to be both fully English and fully Catholic, whether it really matters or not that the next coronation is going to involve oaths that don't reflect the reality of the social and religious context, and perhaps most importantly, has the time come for the Catholic Church to take responsibility for being the principal and most coherent church in these islands as Anglicanism diminishes in numbers, coherence and conviction. Any conversation with Serena leaves one both better informed and cheerfully entertained. Fluidly articulate and, as always, a delight to talk to, he joins me now. Serena James, welcome to the Catholic Podcast. You're one of the guys. You're on the team. You are deputy, assistant, almost chief. What's your real title in our setup?
Well, hello there, Gavin. Thanks for having me on your inestimable podcast. Well, good question. I'm something of a jack of all trades and master of none at the moment, but I've certainly spent most of this morning going through the January edition, which is so strange to think that we've got to get the January edition to press before Christmas. But that's publishing. That's newspapers for you. So yes, I think a broad remit that gives me plenty of stuff to get my teeth into and stuff to enjoy and lots of the cultural stuff, which I really love, and trying to sort of make sure that everyone else is getting their stuff in and it's all going to go smoothly, as of course it always does, always.
You have a fourth string to your bow, so to speak. You're also a professional ecclesiastical historian. What are your dates?
I mean, I suppose I started out as a historian really of the long 19th century, sort of from about 1780 to 1914. 1914, of course, being the outbreak of the First World War, which seemed a good place to take my interest to at that point. And then 1780, of course, the year of the Gordon riots in London, of that great nominally anti-Catholic rioting in London. I'm not terribly convinced it was actually anti-Catholic rioting in London. I think it was just rioting in London with a convenient peg. But then more lately, I've taken it right up to the present day because I developed an interest in the role of religion in the British Empire, and particularly religious philanthropy through the work of the religious orders. So I've sort of really brought it up to date. But it's all taken a back seat at the moment. I'm not actively researching at the moment, but I've kept on my teaching at Oxford, and I'm still turning out the odd article and learned review here and there. My life is like one long essay crisis, really. So there's always something to be done. I've got a chapter in a book coming out with OUP early next year on Victorian religious responses to animal testing, of all things, to vivisection. So it's quite very. But I suppose yes, as you're kind of saying, but I suppose I certainly did sort of set out on this adventure as a church historian. So it's the editorial work at the Herald is a rather fun way to be combining all these different strands.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the Gordon riots like that, because I think from a more amateurish perspective, I too think it was probably the London mob just being the London mob in a particular context. But one of the things I've had to do...
It was heartening aboard, you know, and there was agitation, and it was more a distraction. I think it was very handy for the government to allow it to be a distraction. But then, of course, like so much of it, got out of control.
Well, let's start with this part of our conversation, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about was to look at the trajectory of the Roman Catholic Church from about, 1780 is a very good place to start, to the present day, because what we have in mind really is the decade that's about to come and a decade following that. So this isn't intended to be an abstract historical discussion, fun and delightful though that would be, but sadly a little bit more responsible in terms of trying to understand what kind of state the church is in, and to do that, we need to know where it's come from. So this presumably is almost, I mean, the only thing I can think of that's similar, and yet it's not similar, is the restitution of Russian Orthodoxy in Russia after 1989. There are some similarities, but just as many differences. The reemergence of Catholicism into English society is presumably something that has nothing similar has ever happened before. It's a very odd phenomenon in European history, isn't it?
I mean, all across Europe and all across history, there have been suppressions, power has always sought to suppress in various contexts. We could go on all day, I suppose, about the different ways in which different states have sought to wield authority over religious movements. I'm taking, you know, take the Society of Jesus. You know, people forget that, you know, in 1783, the Society of Jesus was suppressed by, you know, Clement XIV, having been, you know, firmly sat on by you know, various crowned heads of Europe who were persuaded that the Jesuits were a rum lot, and persuaded him to suppress them. You know, and they weren't then restored until, you know, Pius VII in 1817. And so you have this sense where, you know, things that are of, you know, good reports come under the purview of, you know, threats and people's nervousness about having fervent believers, for example, having too much power and too much influence in society. I mean, the English situation is unique in that it's unique in that it was essentially precipitated by a crisis at the heart of its own self-understanding in Rome. So, for example, you know, you can trace the most important date for the Catholic Church in England and Wales. I think you have to see them in the same breath. Scotland is quite distinct, as it happens, because the Scottish history is separate. But in England and Wales, the most significant date is 1570 and Pius V's bull Renens in Excelsis, in which the Pope unwittingly, I don't think it was a deliberate act, but unwittingly, with the best advice available to him, essentially served up the Elizabethan administration, English Catholics on a plate, because from that moment, William Cecil was able to pull off an absolute coup. I mean, all credit to Cecil. It's an absolute coup in that he's able to intimate that it's impossible to be both a good Catholic and a loyal Englishman. And that is a sentiment that has lingered ever since. The first piece I ever wrote for the Catholic Herald was during the visit of Pope Benedict to London. And it was, I mean, this slightly says something about me in the historian, in that when everyone else was going to Hyde Park to see Pope Benedict, I was on my way to Piccadilly to watch the protests against his visit, which was fascinating because it was quite clear. Some protests were, you know, some of the protesters were clearly informed. They had taken particular, you know, issue with particular points of Catholic social teaching and chosen to engage with those. A lot of them, I think, were simply there in the good old-fashioned anti-Catholic tradition of the London mob.
No popery.
And so it was rather nice. In one way, it was rather nice to see, you know, that historical reality sort of representing itself in front of me. But there has been, for centuries, this visceral antipathy towards Catholicism in the minds of most Englishmen. Now, over the last 50, 60, 70 years, we then have to sort of recalibrate as to what we mean by someone who is English, Welsh, British. But it lingered for a very long time. And there was a lot of opposition in various directions to the idea of any kind of extra liberties for Catholics, taking the 1780s. That's where the excuse for the Gordon riots comes. The idea of an element of emancipation coming in for English Catholics. But the daftness there, of course, is that the penal laws, which were brought in absolutely to control English Catholics, had been a dead letter for over a century. No one was really interested in the penal laws. In fact, I suspect most people had forgotten they existed until, of course, it came to the suggestion that they should, at least in part, be repealed.
I'd just like to lift up the stone a little bit of you cannot be a good Englishman and a Catholic. It's certainly the way I grew up. My best friend, when I grew up in Southwest London, was rather odd because he was Catholic and he went to Catholic masses in Wimbledon. I remember thinking, I am the Englishman here. I go to the Wimbledon Parish Church where I sing in the choir. I'm part of the establishment. And he goes to places where there are Italians and French people and statues and something that's really culturally and nationalistically really quite alien. And I want to ask the question, not in order to be provocative, but in order to try and unravel the elements. One of the things that has irked me a great deal is my understanding of our cathedrals. I remember the first time I heard a Catholic say to me, you know, you blighters, you should give them back. And I went, this is outrageous. They're ours. They're Anglican cathedrals. You know, they've always been Anglican cathedrals. And then slowly over the years, a more nuanced sense of the relationship of these stones has begun to emerge for me. But hasn't the Church of England, or hasn't the establishment, the Anglican establishment, played quite a large part in de-Anglicizing Catholicism by claiming inheritance that actually I don't think it legitimately has. I mean, ownership is nine-tenths of the law. Absolutely. It owns them. But it strikes me that the kind of kinetic impetus of de-Anglicizing Catholicism is still part of what the Anglican Church has up its sleeve as a way of maintaining its position, I think, improperly in the public consciousness. Is that fair or conspiratorial?
I think that is fair. And I think it's come to the fore in the identity of the Catholic Church in this country in a number of ways. For example, I mean, after the Irish famine, as working class Irish immigrants poured into Liverpool and then from Liverpool throughout the Northwest, that was a huge moment of reckoning for the English Catholic Church because two reasons. First of all, the English Catholic Church had been, people felt, genuinely English and was being diluted by the idea of even though, of course, the Irish at that point were British. There was no sense of them being, they were countrymen, but they were part of the United Kingdom, but they were nevertheless Irish. But the other issue was to some extent a class issue, because in the 1860s, there was a huge identity before really the great immigration of the Industrial Revolution began and took hold and people landed permanently. There was a sense in which Catholicism was also a genteel, erudite, thinking religion. And so there were two concerns that you can see through people's correspondence at the period of this idea. First, that there was this great Irish influx into the English Catholic Church, but there was also this great influx of working class Catholics, which was relatively new. It's not to say there weren't working class Catholics, of course there were, but for such a large group to exist in one place and then begin to spread out through the diaspora was something that people noted. A few people expressed concern, but it was generally just something that was noted. But you can also see this today. I mean, if you look at your experience in Southwest London, in our large cities, it is perfectly normal to have a multiracial, essentially immigrant congregation in a Catholic church. In the countryside, it's a different story. So as you know, I grew up in Mid Wales. I remember heartily one assumption. I was staying with friends near Llandovery, and there's a beautiful little Catholic church in Llandovery, and going in for the Mass of the Assumption, where an Indian priest in front of a congregation of essentially farmers coming down from the various mountain farms to come to Mass on the solemnity, as bidden by the church, preached a stonkingly magnificent sermon against communism. And it was a sort of a meeting of various diasporas. But the makeup of the of congregations changes wherever you go. But I think to bring that back, the essential Englishness of the English Catholic Church has, I think, always been on shifting sands, because there was always an Irish element from its resurgence to a greater or lesser extent. And there's always been, you know, it's certainly in Wales and in the Northwest and in Birmingham, a sense of an Irish identity. Now, elsewhere, there's been an undercurrent of Italian identity, particularly in the Welsh Valleys. There's a huge Italian aspect to the Catholic Church. I think the issue is when it comes to what the English Catholic Church is, its identity historically, before, but also during mass immigration, its identity, of course, was always linked to the penal era, to the penal laws, to the age of the martyrs. And I think that was an identity that sustained the Catholic Church for a very long time, and it was culturally a thing. And so, to go back to your point about cathedrals and things that were stolen and things that were taken away, I think while the 40 martyrs were the abiding influence on people's identity as Catholics, then that was an understandable response, perhaps. I'm not sure that still prevails now. I think English Catholic identity is a different beast. And I think there are various elements for that. I think as the church in England has become much more diverse through immigration, through intermarriage, through all sorts of ways, as it's become more diverse, I think the idea of the English martyrs, which were so much part of the English Catholic identity for so long, I think that's been diluted. I'm not saying that's a woeful thing. I just think it's a, obviously, I think the 40 martyrs have their place liturgically. And I know for a fact that, you know, with my teaching hat on, I know that the syllabus requires kids in Catholic schools to study the history of that period in this country. And so they haven't disappeared. They're still there, worthy of honour and of inspiration, and if you like. But I think the idea of what it is now to be an English Catholic, I think if I can propose, it's shifted. I do wonder whether people are no longer necessarily English Catholics with all that entailed, and whether now actually people are Catholics in England. I wonder whether finally what immigration has done is it has finally removed any kind of sense of English cisalpinism and reserve, and that the ultramontane project brought in by people like Manning and others from the 1860s has finally triumphed utterly because of European immigration into this, and not just European immigration, but particularly European immigration, because with Eastern European immigration into this country came not only large numbers of Catholics, but large numbers of Catholics from places where culturally Catholicism was vibrant and an essential part of the fabric of life. It'll be interesting to see now post-Brexit, actually, how that pans out. But that will take 10, 20 years, I think, for us to be able to discern the actual outcome. So that's for the historians of the future. But I think there has been this shift.
Three things occur to me. One is that two ingredients were missing that would have allowed a sense of English, being English and Catholic, to have retained were first of all, an understanding of the Middle Ages, because not many people know about the Middle Ages. So it's almost as if for a lot of people, such history as they have starts at the Reformation or the Renaissance, and you know, the Middle Ages, they're not the new Dark Ages, but they're not really accessible. Whereas as I began to read, particularly in mysticism, I began to think that actually 13th, 14th, and 15th, 16th centuries were almost the highest point of human culture in Europe in terms of what they produced, in terms of architecture and polyphony and elements of civilized mutuality between rulers and subjects. It seemed to me that it hardly ever got better than that.
The other thing, you know, in England, it's important to remember, look, take it back to Julius Caesar and the arrival of the Romans in England, and go into the mindset of some poor Roman soldier, you know, probably not from Rome himself, probably perhaps from Spain, perhaps from Gaul, you know, standing on Hadrian's Wall, looking at this, out at this bleak Scottish, you know, lowlands, and freezing cold, and just thinking, what on earth are we doing here? Oh, we're defending Anglia. You know, we're defending Anglia from you know, from the Hibernians. Why? What's the point? You know, this godforsaken, freezing cold island. That sense of what did England have to bring to the party? And I think it's really important to realise that into the Middle Ages, going to the pre-Tudor period, going to the Wars of the Roses. At the time of the Wars of the Roses, we all say, oh, and one of the Wars of the Roses was bad for, it was bad for trade because England was mainly arable and farming and sheep and wool and exports. Now, it's true that there was a period where English culture produced some of the finest work in Europe. If you think of the Opus Anglicanum stuff, think of, you know, the V&A's various exhibitions about Opus Anglicanum work, the items we still have, English metalwork, English needlework, English luxury fabrics, all these things were hugely desirable. But they were hugely desirable exports. It's true that a lot of stuff stayed in England, but most the stuff we have that survives on the continent is there because on the continent there was this immensely vibrant civic life in which church and state functioned in a way that was much more organic, I suspect, than it functioned in England. However, this sense that England was somehow this all-singing, all-dancing centre of immense culture and throwing off, you know, the bonds of the church in the Reformation freed it to be truly itself, I think is a great misnomer.
Yes, I'm sure that's right.
Because the the loss of the input of the Catholic Church to the English way of life in the middle of the 16th century was at least a cultural disaster, and in some places it was socially catastrophic, and it took a while to recover. I'm not saying that it didn't recover in different ways, but it was the ripping out of the cultural heart of most communities.
Peter Ackroyd has a very interesting point to make here. He says that 90% of the world's ghost stories originate in England. And this is a very unusual phenomenon. I mean, it's spectacularly unusual. And in giving his mind to why this might be, because it's a very rich genre, he says that he thinks it's all to do with a kind of post-traumatic disorder from the destruction of the monasteries and the whole cultural impact of prayer, of being able to pray for the dead. And so that the moment in England where this dreadful, almost schizophrenic schism came, where one day you were in touch with your ancestors in prayer and in love and in continuity and in metaphysics, as you, that lovely word you use, a kind of organic relationship. But the next day, the next few decades, it wasn't allowed. And there's this incredible sense of loss. And Ackroyd, I think, quite cleverly suggests that this becomes repressed and goes underground. And like all things that are repressed, comes out in a rather wonky way, in our case, in terms of ghost stories. But the point of mentioning that is, it seems, if he's right, and he might be, it seems to me to be a very powerful illustration that the impact of this appalling schism, this earthquake, this cultural, historical, and psychological canyon in English affairs, from which I think we've never recovered. And the very fact that we're unable, partly because having no access to the Middle Ages. The other thing I was going to say, partly having the middle class having no part in it. Catholicism was either working class or it was haute bourgeoisie and aristocracy.
Yes, but also, I mean, don't forget, I mean, the concept of a middle class is a relatively late development anyway, you know, because you either, the middle classes were very small for most of history until they then became the largest set. But take that point. Historically, Catholicism in this country, the idea that Catholicism is a religion of the middle classes is a very recent development. Because Catholicism was until the eve of the First World War, Catholicism was, it was the religion of the labouring classes, and it was the religion of the gentry, with the occasional aristocrat thrown in. The same is true there with conversions. You know, you have these aristocratic conversions. What you don't have is the respectability of the middle class. If I may be impious for a moment, the best description of that in British popular culture is in Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, and that remarkable setup of the song Every Sperm is Sacred, in which the joke is, the trope of a poor Irish Catholic family, Irish immigrant family, having more children than they can afford because of the teachings of the church and all this sort of... And then people forget the real joke of that song is... By the way, I think if I'm right, they spent the entire budget on the film on that sequence because there's a joyousness to it. It's a really interesting observation that the situation seems pretty miserable, but nevertheless, the next thing, it burst out in song, singing, dancing. But the joke that people don't, unless they know the film well, and I'm afraid I do know the film well, the joke is that at the end of the song, as they are all being led off to wherever they're being led, to the orphanage or medical experiments, I think it's where they're being, you know, taken, the shot cuts to their respectable middle-class Protestant neighbours who are talking about them. And the proposition, I think, the director of the film is making is, well, who actually is living life to the full here? Because there's a very ribald comment in that he explains why the Catholics have so many children. And he explains very quite well the Catholics, the moral teaching on contraception. And he uses this rather line, said, you know, we could be doing it every night of the week if we wanted to. And she simply says, well, why don't we? It's the grayness of middle-class respectable religion set against the colour, but also the anguish and the difficulty of working class Catholicism. It's a cultural point that I think that film makes incredibly well. Of, we still see it today. You know, we still see it today of the, you know, the middle class disapproval of large families, of anything that breaks the, you know, the norm, such as it, you know, well, 2.4 children or whatever it's, you know, the average is, we are told the average is.
But this is residual Puritanism. I mean, what we're actually seeing, yes, I think, what you so beautifully described, is the legacy of Puritanism, which is still rooted in whatever the middle class is, trying very desperately, you know, what is that wonderful definition of a Puritan? Someone who's terribly afraid that somebody else, somewhere else may be happy.
The great Puritan story was the absolute forbidding of sex up against a wall, lest it lead to dancing.
That's right.
You know, this sense of, yeah, precisely, you know, of skewed priorities that essentially made a misery of the observance of the, of God's law. And that is it's not a post-Reformation quality. It's a Commonwealth legacy, I think, that actually, I think we forget about the Commonwealth. We forget about those bizarre, sort of that bizarre decade and a half. I do think actually in terms of the Reformation, yes, life changed forever for most Englishmen at the Reformation. But the Commonwealth, I think, did in a very short period of time just as much, if not more, change in that it was mainly during the Commonwealth that churches were despoiled. I think the idea that the despoilation of the English parish church took place during the Reformation period, I think, is a bit of a red herring, that I think the Commonwealth had its part to play in that as well.
Let me just ask you a question, because whilst I've got a tame historian here, there are a number of lenses through which we can see things, and I after once tried the psychological and the factual and the economic, one sometimes gets to the metaphysical, which may be the driving force. What was the rage in the Commonwealth? What is the Puritan rage against faith in stone and art? If one does one's theology in the Old Testament, one discovers that actually the Ark of the Covenant involved some statues, some carvings. I mean, the Old Testament has carvings in it. It is extraordinary balance between the empty space and the Holy of Holies and stuff that was made. But this can't just have been a misreading of the Old Testament. Where did the visceral hatred of beauty come from?
I'm not sure it's a visceral hatred of beauty. I think it's just the, you know, if you've laid violent hands upon the Lord's anointed, and I am not of the school that Charles I was blameless in the situation that led to his execution at Whitehall. I think he miscalculated on a number of points and was totally unwilling to compromise. And I think he possibly could have saved his head if he'd been willing to compromise on certain points. But then the narrative very quickly became that of the martyr king. But if you have laid violent hands on the Lord's anointed, because that is what he was, by terms of the you know, England's own understanding of its monarchy, and even post-Reformation, its monarchy was regarded as a sacral monarchy. Its coronation rites were outwardly Catholic. If they might have been divorced from Rome, but they were Catholic rites administered by Anglicans, which is a huge question, of course, now leading up to the King's own coronation in May. Charles I was, by anyone's reckoning, the Lord's anointed. Once you have lopped the head off the Lord's anointed, you are not going to be too bothered by a window or a picture. And that's the remarkable thing, that it wasn't just the removal of images and the removal of things of beauty from churches. It was a very clear warning. That's why we have these defaced rood screens. It's that sort of, yeah, we have done this. We have done this. This is the world now.
Right, that's very good.
You're stuck with it. Except, of course, they're only stuck with it then until the Restoration, when Charles II comes back and in 1660. And then, of course, Charles II decides that, you know, goes completely mad and starts digging up corpses and having them and has them, you know, has corpses executed, and it, you know, it all goes completely crazy because the return of the king is not necessarily the peaceable, you know, the peaceable forgiving return that people might have hoped for. But these warnings of the new state religion, that's where the Puritanism comes from. That's where this visceral Puritanism enters society at a time, of course, and in terms of the middle classes, at a time where the aristocracy are in a very difficult position because their the fount of honour on which their position relies has ceased to be. Lord Protector Cromwell is essentially the exaltation, he's the living embodiment of the exaltation of the English middle classes. So, of course, Puritanism becomes the religion of the middle classes, because for a bit, they're in control. And then, of course, the king comes back, and then things change. But you're still left with the trading middle classes.
It's always about power. Power and the legitimization of the threat. This is, there are three things we have to talk about before we stop, because we're going to run out of time, and they're so interesting. Well, one is I think we must talk about the coronation and the oath and the implications of the fact that they can't change. They haven't got time to change the words, but if they don't change the words, the very foundation of the monarchy then becomes problematic because it's incoherent in so many ways. The other thing I want to very briefly talk about is your very powerful notion that civic identity is going to have nationalism removed, because who knows what it is to be English anymore. I mean, the idea that we're Catholics in England rather than English Catholics, I think is a fascinating way of making sense of the way in which the cultural identities have shifted and will continue to shift. And the third thing, if we're able to, is there any prospect at all that the Catholic Church in England can recover its sense of being Catholics in England, if not English Catholics? Can this shift to being Catholics in England allow it to develop the confidence of a joined-up identity through history, which allows it to be the basic Christian community? Because numerically, it is now. Both numerically, conceptually, theologically, ethically, it's the Christian community with the greatest coherence. Is there any way it can overcome the kind of punishment beating it's had at the hands of the Church of England, which has been intended to delegitimize it as the English Church and continues to this day, and I think needs to be confronted? So first of all, very quickly, the monarchy. They're not going to be able to change the oath making him defender of the Protestant faith. What on earth is that going to do to the... I mean, Charles has got this incoherence built in. I want to defend all faiths. The first thing he did in the first week of taking over was to bring all the faith community leaders together and reiterate that nonsense that he talked about 30 years ago.
Yes, but also having sworn to protect the independence of the Presbyterian Church in Scotland.
Yes, I know, absolutely. I mean, so wonderfully ludicrous.
The most remarkable thing is that for all his signs when he was Prince of Wales, the king has essentially... let me put it another way. As a correspondent of mine pointed out after the South African State Banquet, he said, "Isn't it remarkable how this new-look monarchy seems to look exactly the same as the old one?" and I think there's truth there. But it is incoherent. And I think to your point about, you know, what will happen if he swears the oath to uphold the Protestant Church, if he swears the oath to uphold the Protestant Church, nothing will change. It will be fine. It will be fine. Life will go on just as it went on under the late Queen.
And that's not because we're introducing postmodernity. It's simply because the English constitution is deeply incoherent. Nobody understands it or cares to understand it. What was that question in 1066 that people never got to understand? Oh, it was the Irish question, of course it was. if you understood the question, then you know the apocalypse would come. No one understands the constitutional.
No, we have to look at the situation of the coronation. There's an incoherence to it anyway. And the greatest incoherence is, I mean, at the moment, is people talking about they want the coronation to be inclusive and accessible. Well, but we're literally anointing and crowning someone who happens to have got the job by, call it an act of providence or a quirk of fate. There is literally no less accessible and no less inclusive thing in the world.
It is the least diverse, least inclusive, least equal. Yes.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the thing that has changed in that oath was that previously there was an inherent suggestion that to uphold and defend the Protestant religion was to actively act against other denominations. And I don't think today that position holds at all. I think it will simply be interpreted to uphold and defend the Protestant religion. Fine, that's a historic thing that we have because we have this quirky history. But the idea that, you know, Charles is not going to the, His Majesty is not going to, he's not going to act in any way to the detriment of his Catholic subjects. The very interesting thing would be to see if the Cardinal goes to the coronation. Because, of course, in 1953, the Catholic Party, although there were a number of Catholics taking part in the ceremony because their positions required it, the Duke of Norfolk, for one, but, you know, the nuncio and the cardinal and the Pope's personal representative sat in a tribune just outside the Abbey. Yes, of course he'll swear to uphold the Protestant religion, but the effect of that, with the best will in the world, I mean, where we are now in the state of the Church of England, who will care?
So we're going to, I don't think we've got time to talk about the idea of being Catholics in England, although it may inform the last, perhaps the most important question, which you've nicely provided a bridge to, which is if the Catholic hierarchy or elements of them are present at the coronation, does that provide a sufficient visual and symbolic springboard to say, we're back? The context of we're being back is that the substance of Anglicanism has evaporated. It's still very rich. It's still deeply embedded in the contradictoriness of the upper echelons of society. They can't take bishops out of the House of Lords. It's much too complicated. They can't remove the Archbishop of Canterbury from his role in society. But the substance of Anglicanism has simply evaporated. There's no one there, effectively. So the only coherent ecclesial body it's only a bit bigger, but it's bigger, is the Catholic Church. And it has, its advantages are that it's here, it belongs, it has a coherent ethical self-understanding. I know we're in the middle of the Civil War, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens, but that's a separate narrative. Is there any way in which Catholics in England will be able to find the confidence to have a dialogue with a secular, anti-religious state sufficient to be able to guard a place for the Christian community in this country as three cultures squabble and fight it out for space, you know, the Islamic culture, the secular culture, and what remains of the Christian culture? If the Catholics can't do it, it's not going to happen at all. They're the only ones who can do it, in my judgment.
I think that's probably a fair assessment. I think the lockdown was a great sort of tester of mettle, really. I don't think the Catholic Church necessarily handled it as well as it might have done, but it did better than many other denominations. The Church of England, to my mind, essentially vacated the public square.
Completely, yeah.
That the response to the lockdown of the Church of England was essentially an admission of defeat. That's not to say there weren't individual Anglicans and individual Anglican clergy who behaved extremely nobly and bravely.
They certainly did.
And in the finest traditions of the old Anglican parish tradition. But that was not the universal response of the Church of England to that time of crisis and need. I think the Catholic Church is probably in a very strong position to take the lead if it's brave enough to do so. But, of course, that will come at a cost. The reality is the Church has to work in the world, and it has to work in the world as the world is, not as it might have it. But I think it's a very interesting point you make, that will the presence of the Cardinal and various other Catholic prelates at the coronation be a sign that the Catholic Church is ready to step up and, you know, fulfil its destiny finally and return? I think the idea of, you know, England returning to Catholicism in the next 100 years is probably a pipe dream. Because don't forget, I don't think for a minute that the Cardinal will be the only non-Anglican religious leader in colourful robes at the coronation. However, if we are going to see it, and I'm reluctant, you mentioned the term civil war, I'm reluctant to see it in quite such bleak terms. Because I think there are a number of, and this is the great sense, you spoke about the Islamic situation. There are a number of moral issues on which the Catholic Church and Islam are aligned.
Absolutely, yes. Very, very powerfully aligned too, yes.
And the same is true of Judaism. I think the greatest thing the Catholic Church could do would be actually to adopt a coherent position of positive engagement with Islamic and Jewish leaders on things like on matters like moral issues. That would be a great service, I think, to the life of the nation. However, to the other point, though, is the Catholic Church in the end going to come out on top? in terms of, you know, denomination top trumps or something, if you like. I think the Church of England is going to retreat into individual congregationalism sooner rather than later. Whether that's a vacuum the Catholic Church, I think that it is a vacuum it's able to fill. Whether it will take the initiative and fill it probably belongs to the next generation of bishops coming through.
Let me just say, for the sake of clarity, that this is not me saying I've changed teams and hooray to my new team, because it could sound like that. I was profoundly influenced by my diocesan bishop in about 2008, I think. We were in a very nasty debate in General Synod, which the traditionalists lost, and he came out in absolute misery, as did I. And he put his arm around me and he said, tonight has seen the end of a 500-year-old ecumenical experiment, which is Anglicanism. And in fact, he was right. The fact that it was the end wasn't the critical thing. We knew we were fighting for life or death at the project. But it was the idea that Anglicanism was an ecumenical experiment. I had never seen the Church of England or Anglicanism in those, if you like, broad historical terms. This is, you know, for 500 years, they tried something. And it might have worked, but it hasn't worked. And so I'm speaking not as a Catholic against an Anglican. I'm speaking as a confessing Christian in a society we're trying to evangelize and save. As we try and evangelize and save our society, how might it best be done in terms of ecclesial identity? So it's not trying to rubbish Anglicanism, which has produced saints and virtues and ethics and intelligence and beauty and art and poetry and so on, especially hymns. But it's trying to gain some sense of what are we going to do now. I hear what you say about a pipe dream. I guess the difference between a pipe dream and a vision is that the vision issues out, gives birth to some kind of reality, and the pipe dream is wishful thinking.
I think probably the life of the nation is going to be poorer with the Church of England taking this back seat. And it is already poorer with the Church of England taking this back seat. Because it seems to me that the Church of England now is determined to move away from its centralisation in the parishes and move that centralisation nearer the centre and adopt particular positions to debate in using its privileged position in Parliament. I think the great opportunity for the Catholic Church is on the ground. But it's not just on the ground. It's not just on the ground with disaffected Anglicans or even Anglicans who've been abandoned. I think it's on the ground in places where there is no longer a coherent Anglican parish system, well, that is the place where the parish church, the Catholic parish church, can come into its own.
Sir James, thank you so much for giving the time to this. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I hope other people enjoy it too. Bless you and thank you.